ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
So join me, Alicia Simmons.
And me, Lee Boucher.
Find it by searching for The Dead Can't Sue on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, it's Hamish McDonald. In our final look at the best of global roaming over the past year, alongside Jerry, our big thinking guests are taking a look at things like wars, at the space race, at the legacies of civil rights movements and security and the economy, just to name a few. It's been a pretty wild ride through a lot of different topics. So on our last episode in this series, perhaps one of the most salient and reflective conversations in Getting Lucky Again. It's about clean energy.
We are doing things a little bit differently in this series. We're handing over to our guests to present us with their ideas first before Hamish and I give them a bit of a grilling.
A light grilling, a sort of summer sear.
Indeed. And this week we're going to be joined by Dr. Alan Finkel. Now, his name's probably pretty familiar to you. He was Australia's eighth chief scientist from 2016 to 2020. And he's been leading the charge on getting Australia to net zero, something I think you'd agree continues to bedevil us. So we're keen to hear where he thinks we should go next to thrive.
Well, it's great to have you with us, Alan, for this Getting Lucky Again series. So we'll let you take it away.
Well, Geraldine and Hamish, I've got to say I've been lucky in life. Most important to me is the good fortune I have enjoyed with my wife, children and extended family. But beyond my family, I've also been lucky to have started, built and sold two successful technology companies. The first was a biotech company that I ran in Silicon Valley in California until we were acquired in 2004 by a bigger NASDAQ-listed company. The second was an edtech company that I started here in Australia in 2012. We were acquired earlier this year by a large Boston-based company. In between and in parallel, among other things, I had 8 wonderful years as Chancellor of Monash University and 5 as Australia's Chief Scientist. Now, that all sounds like good fortune, luck, if you like, and it was. It's worth noting, though, that you can influence the odds in your favour. For example, when a spectator derided Gary Player's astonishing bunker shots as being lucky, the world-famous golfer gave this pithy response. He said, "The harder I practice, the luckier I get." Or, as French microbiologist Louis Pasteur put it, "Chance favours the prepared mind." Australia has been lucky for more than 200 years. In recent times, however, it feels that our luck is running low. Should we blame this on the world having become more complicated? Or should we blame ourselves? Unfortunately, I believe it's the latter. When it comes to influencing our future odds, we are neither as prepared as Pasteur would have liked, nor as practiced as Player advised. Consider future exports. I have written in the past, as has Ross Garneau and others, about Australia's opportunity to be a green energy superpower. We could be exporting green iron instead of raw iron ore. We could be exporting sunshine embedded in sustainable jet fuel, fertilizer, and aluminium oxide. However, we are yet to take the first baby steps to achieve this vision. And that's because having an abundance of natural resources, it's not enough. We also need win-win regulatory systems, ones that simultaneously facilitate business and protect our environment. Instead, we have regulatory systems that are closer to win-lose. They protect the local environment at the expense of economic progress, with no trade-off for national and global environmental benefits. Because of the heavy hand of state and federal regulators, the rate of new wind farm construction commencements this year, it's the lowest in a decade. At under 300 megawatts, it is about a tenth of the commencements we need every year to meet the 82% renewables target. Faced with a similar dilemma, in 2023, the Europeans reformed their sclerotic regulatory system through accelerated permitting rules. As a result, solar and wind deployment in Europe in 2024 was double compared with 2021. Contrast that with Australia, in which the average annual increase in solar and wind electricity generation in the 3 years to 2024, it actually decreased by a third compared to the previous 3 years. Decreased despite ambitious targets introduced in 2022. The recently passed environmental protection reform bills, they might help, but at more than 1,400 pages of complex details, it's too soon to tell. Targets are not the solution. A game plan based on strategy, tactics, and implementation is the way to go. In China, the pace of progress is almost beyond belief. Their annual deployment of solar and wind power, nuclear power and hydroelectric power exceeds the rest of the world combined. These deployments are augmented by investments in transmission lines and storage and natural gas production that have helped to ensure that China's electricity remains cost competitive and reliable. Key to China's success is that it implements strategies and business plans from which targets emerge. This is what I did in both my companies. We never set a target to be number one in our niche markets. But in both cases, that's what we became by coordinated planning, hard work, listening to customers, and a relentless commitment to quality. We are fast approaching the stability limits for our electricity grids because we have failed to adequately invest in the transmission lines, grid enhancements, and security technologies that a solar and wind-dominated electricity system requires. We will not be able to shut down coal-fired electricity generators until we have built sufficient alternative generation to push them out. Energy delivery from new solar farms and wind farms and solar rooftops is what counts. While batteries help to integrate new solar and wind, they are irrelevant from the point of view of replacing the electricity from coal-fired generation. That's because batteries do not produce energy. Their role is to store it to be used at a later time. It baffles me when governments celebrate battery installations as if they were equivalent to solar and wind farm installations. And another thing that baffles me is the negative attitude directed towards natural gas to fill the final gaps in electricity generation. Despite the claims of purists who aim for 100% renewable electricity, we need gas-fired electricity to ensure a stable and reliable electricity system in the presence of high levels of solar and wind generation. Instead, by demonizing gas, we have failed to invest in discovery and production. Our East Coast wholesale gas prices have tripled in the last 10 years, with most economists blaming international trends. In my view, the blame lies in years of policy failure by state and federal governments. Instead of vilifying natural gas, we should invest in opening up new reserves and aim for something like a long-term 80-20 split between renewable and gas-fired electricity. The 20% of electricity generated from natural gas would stabilize the electricity grid, and it would replace the last of the coal-fired generators and their much higher emissions. There are fortunately some places in Australia where we are doing well. These lie in the knowledge ecosystem that capitalizes on our education system and our innovation culture. These industries are less impeded by the heavy hand of government regulation. It translates into success in digital tech, where companies like Canva, Atlassian, and Blackmagic Design have been international superstars. Another area we do well is the development of pharmaceutical drugs, medical devices and clinical trials. Think Cochlear, CSL and ResMed, and some recent vaccine startups. In the medical space, the Therapeutic Goods Administration oversees a sensible regulatory system that understands that if all risk were to be avoided, we would never bring new cancer drugs or dementia drugs to market. Future generations would not thank us. The medical regulations balance the need to facilitate development and protect patients. Why can't our environmental regulations be as sensible? Now, I began my talk by mentioning that I've been lucky in the businesses I have started. Please wish me luck, because I've just started another company. This time in the area of voluntary certification of the human origins of creative outputs, such as books, music, and videos. This might be the most important project I have ever undertaken. Today, artificial intelligence tools are being used to produce music in which no human lyricists, composers, or performers are involved. That it is happening is not the essential problem. The problem is that the use of AI is not being disclosed. Art is the quintessential expression of a fellow human being. Much of my appreciation of music comes from being awestruck by the genius of the composer and the human story behind their work. Same with books and movies. I want to make a choice, but if I am not informed about the human versus AI origins, how can I choose? If my new company is successful in certifying the human origins of creative outputs, I will have helped to preserve an essential human right, the right to the information that empowers an informed choice to choose human. So once again, please wish me luck.
Oh, we do wish you luck, Alan. Thank you very much indeed in your quest to make sure that Beethoven's of the future can come through and be real. Look, while you catch your breath, let me remind listeners that you're listening to ABC Radio National's Global Roaming with me, Geraldine Duke.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. We're here to explore new ideas for Australia in this challenging global moment. With us on this episode is Australia's former chief scientist, Alan Finkel. Alan, we will come to the AI venture and all of the challenges and opportunities that AI presents, but I suppose your passionate argument in favour of gas is something that will have, you know, piqued listeners' interest. It's not new that you're making that argument on the national stage. I remember talking about this with you 4 or 5 years ago, and I wonder whether you think the mood around gas, the attitudes toward gas, have actually changed a bit since then.
Hamish, I think it has, certainly in the upper echelons of government and within the experts in the energy industry. I'm not sure that it's changed yet amongst the broader community. I mean, the arguments for using natural gas for the last 20% or thereabouts of our electricity system transition is firstly that it replaces coal in a very reliable way that solar and wind can't. And coal emissions are much worse than the emissions from natural gas generation. And the second is that the costs of an electricity system based on solar and wind go up as the percentage share of the total electricity generation over the course of a year increases. And if you actually aspire to 100%, the costs become ridiculous, because the cost of solar and wind electricity, it's not the issue of the free sunshine and the free wind or the inexpensive solar panels. It's all the electronics and deployment of the solar panels, the transmission lines that have to distribute the power, the batteries that store it. The balance of system becomes overwhelmingly expensive with variable solar and wind powered electricity. And gas can truly take the pain, the cost and reliability pain, out of a modern electricity system based on solar and wind.
See, you do say, Alan, that the clean energy transition is humanity's biggest ever economic challenge. Therefore, maybe that does explain how hard we're finding it, although you suggest that if we had a better plan, which of course is a typically communist party thing, you know, authoritarian systems have five-year plans, we haven't had that sort of thing. Is that what you're alluding to? Why would it be, why, how could we do it better such that it wasn't such a sort of psychic challenge to us?
You know, Geraldine, I'm not sure that we need a five-year plan, but gosh, it's it has some attractions. Look how well it's served China. They have a five-year plan and they are absolutely leading the world on all clean technologies, solar, wind, nuclear power, hydroelectric power, heat pumps, cars.
It's now about 10% of their economy, I read. And, you know, it's really powering economic growth. It's real.
Oh, it absolutely is. Now, I'm not suggesting that we want to live under a political system like that, but for a time of transition, it's very effective. I mean, if you think about the original electricity system, I'm more familiar with Victoria than other states, but the State Electricity Commission of Victoria was established in the 1920s under the CEO and chairmanship, both roles of General Sir John Monash. And there was no market economics involved at all. We went from a electricity-free system to complete coverage of the state by planning and commitment and just getting the job done. When you're going through a transition, it's not because of businesses seeing opportunity, but it's being forced upon us because of the externality of climate change. Under those circumstances, normal economics, normal market conditions don't apply. And so there is something attractive about a centrally planned transition, but realistically, that's not going to happen in Australia. So we have to, at the very least, get rid of the barriers to the transition. We've got a situation where the government sets the targets, and then the government is the enemy because the government is managing the regulatory barriers that make it difficult to achieve the targets. We have to break through that.
So is there a point in your mind at which this becomes not a drag on economic growth but a driver of it? If we barrel on with the green energy transition as we are, does that moment occur anytime soon?
Look, in principle, it can, but it's slipping away. As I said in my introductory remarks, I've talked about Australia becoming a green energy superpower, as has Ross Garnaut and others. But we're making no progress towards it because to be a green energy superpower, we've got to take advantage of the sunshine and wind that we've got. And you don't export that. You embody that in finished products, such as green iron and clean aluminium and green fertilizers. But none of that happens unless the price, the cost, I should say, of our electricity is incredibly cheap. And in principle, it could be, but we're nowhere near that.
I noticed that you don't mention green hydrogen. People seem to have given up on that idea. Have you?
Well, green hydrogen, when we did the national hydrogen strategy that I led, we never set any targets because it was all too elusive. What we said is we've got to be adaptive. And what has turned out is that hydrogen is probably going to have very little, if any, role in energy storage or heating our homes. But where green hydrogen will be, and it's in the early stages, will be increasingly important is its use as a chemical. Because don't forget, a lot of the use of natural gas and oil is as a chemical feedstock. And that necessarily results not only in the chemical products, but in carbon dioxide. It's a byproduct that you don't want. If you make green hydrogen, you can actually upconvert it into those chemical feedstocks to make the pharmaceuticals, the explosives, whatever it is that you need, the plastics. Green hydrogen will be important as a chemical.
And we can transport it too, can't we? Isn't that part of it that we can, am I right there?
Well, transporting as hydrogen is expensive, but if you, for example, use hydrogen to make sustainable aviation fuel, now you're transporting it as regular jet fuel. We've got incredibly powerful logistics systems for doing that. So I don't see much future in transporting hydrogen as hydrogen, but hydrogen embodied as a chemical feedstock into higher value products will be, I believe, very important.
Why has the medical world got it right, and this area of clean technology not. Like, you make that point that there's an ideal balance on offer between testing new products and sort of keeping the safety of the wider public until we're sure where we're going. But we do try. And we don't seem to have been able to effortlessly do that in this world of environmental challenges.
You're right, Geraldine. There's an extraordinary difference between the two regulatory systems. Partly, I think the regulatory system for medicine has been something that the average politician and citizen doesn't really engage with or comprehend. And so it's left to the regulators to work out a perfect solution. But we put political pressure on the environment regulatory system to respond to the needs and or the preferences of voters. And so it's really politically driven rather than driven by the need to find the optimum balance between facilitation of opportunity and protection of people and environment.
So if there's an opportunity, however limited, for Australia still to become a clean energy superpower, what does that look like? What would we be doing that we're not currently? Like, we talk so much about exporting commodities to China. What about the region that we live in, the fastest growing economy in the history of the world?
It all comes back to the same thing we've talked about, Hamish. Everything depends on a low cost of energy, and going to the future, energy is electricity. They're almost synonymous. If we are going to have industry here and help our region through adding value to the minerals that we mine, we need cheap electricity. So we would add value for the world if we could ship refined aluminium at low cost compared to bauxite, green iron or even green steel compared to iron ore. There's enormous opportunity to double or triple, I don't know the exact number, our total exports by adding value here rather than shipping the raw products to other places. But it all comes down to having cheap energy.
So does that suggest that we do need to boost public and private investment in clean technologies, which is classic subsidy territory, which, of course, you know, we've allegedly moved away from all that because it can lead you to picking winners, which can make, I mean, you know, can you can make mistakes there. And it it doesn't necessarily engender strong, robust new development.
You know, if you don't take a chance on picking winners, then you might miss out on many, many opportunities. So private industry, entrepreneurs, start businesses all the time, and you know, we know that 9/10 of startups never make it. I think government has to be less fearful of picking winners and more interested in deep dive evaluation and moving quickly, because the market demands evolve quickly.
Alan, I'm interested in asking you a bit about AI and what you're planning to do to, I suppose, certify human creative pursuits. Why does that matter particularly?
Well, you know, Hamish, I deeply believe that part of our human identity is the way we socially interact with other humans, but also how we exchange our creative outputs, our appreciation of other people's creativity and their appreciation of ours. So when I look at a painting, I don't just look at the painting and say, oh, is it a good painting or a bad painting? I look at a really good painting and I think, oh my God, the talent of that painter. I'm almost jealous in my admiration of the painter. Or if you listen to Beethoven's Ninth, it's magnificent, and part of the awe and the appreciation and the enjoyment is thinking to yourself, and my God, he was deaf by the time he composed that. So to me, it makes a difference. The AI might produce music that is objectively as good as some music in the same genre, but I don't want to listen to the AI music. And most people, in fact, everybody whom I speak to would agree with me on that. I'm sure there are other people who don't, but I've spoken to a lot of people. People want to appreciate and enjoy art, videos, and books that were created by humans. The trouble is, how do you exercise your choice if you don't know? If there's a false name put on the book as the author, a false name put on the music as the composer. And governments are aware of this. It's not like I'm the first person to think of it. Governments, regulators, industry associations, representative associations, what they're trying to do is through regulations force the disclosure of AI origin? And it's too difficult.
The research, though, is showing us that the better you think you are at spotting the fake, the worse you are at doing so. So if we can't tell, what does it matter?
Well, first of all, because that's exactly what I was talking about, it does matter in terms of my, speaking for myself, my human identity, my social interaction. It matters to me who composed something. It's not only the question of how good it is, but the fact
that there's human. What if it doesn't matter? What if it doesn't matter? Sorry to cut across you, but I mean, the awful thought is, what if it doesn't matter to the people coming on, Alan? What does that do to your perception of humanity?
It's a good question. You know, so often, like, people say to me, "Oh, Alan, it's a great idea, and I care," but you know, young people won't care. But I speak to young people, and they care almost more than older people, because they either are, or they've got friends who are musicians, and they see how those opportunities are being completely undermined. There is broad interest. So the idea that we've got is to flip it on its head. Instead of requiring the disclosure of AI origin, which is very, very difficult and has not been successfully done, we want to certify through a validation process the human origin of specified creative outputs. So a book author would come to us, go through a rigorous process of proving to us that he or she is human and wrote the book that we're examining, and we use sophisticated tools to verify that, then they get a stamp. It's a bit like having an organic food stamp. It tells you that those tomatoes were grown provably according to the rules of organic farming.
See, we're all going to have to walk around in the future with a little watermark floating
well, that's
above
right.
us, aren't we?
you're well into the future with it. You'll have humanoid robots that will be indistinguishable.
Alan, you've given us plenty to think about. Now, we always invite our guests to provide some recommendations. A few people might have punched through one or two books already. Anything you've got to recommend?
Well, just the last few that I've read. The most recent book that I've read is an old, old book by Mark Twain, The Prince and the Pauper, which is fun to read because it's a historical novel and he writes so well, but it's just such an illustration of how wonderful life is now compared to what it was in 16th century England, where if you were poor, you know, your rights under the law were non-existent. If you were wealthy or a king, your rights and privileges under the law were beyond belief. And it's really illuminating. Another one that I read recently was called Sea Scraper by Benjamin Wood. And it's just about the life of a young man working in Northern England, rotten job, scraping shrimp off the beach. And by luck, an American film producer comes into his life and totally transforms his life. And it's pretty uplifting. But the third one I want to quickly mention is a book by my wife, Elizabeth Finkel, who recently published a book called Prove It, on the importance of evidence and scientific thinking to guide our decision-making processes across our society. And it's getting rave reviews, so I thought I'd throw one in as well.
Have you certified it as human produced?
Guaranteed.
Alan Finkel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's been beautifully challenging for someone like me who doesn't effortlessly read matters scientific. Our email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Please write to us and tell us your ideas for how you think Australia can get lucky again. We'd really love to hear them.
We'll be back with a fresh episode with you on Monday. I'll be joined by Laura Tingle. I'll see you then.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.